Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, hackers, fake news, and a plot to take down the global economy. These are the issues at the heart of the new spy novel by Washington Post columnist David Ignatius. Ignatius has covered the U.S. intelligence community for decades, and for nearly that long, he's transformed the true stories of his reporting into thrilling tales that explore some of the biggest international issues of the day. In his new work, The Paladin, Ignatius turns his focus to cybersecurity and the growing threat posed not only by the spread of misinformation, but the ability to manufacture reality. David Ignatius, it's so good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be back with you. I think back of all my books, Diane, and how I think with each one of them, the first event that I did to launch my book was appearing on your show. So it's wonderful.
Let's start with your main character, Michael Dunn. Tell us a little about him, who he is, and of course, the book begins as he's coming out of prison.
Michael Dunn is a CIA officer in the so-called Science and Technology, S&T division, which is a kind of blue-collar part of the CIA. They put the bugs in place. They do a lot of the technical details of spying. He's an interesting character to me because of his background. He's from the Rust Belt in America. He grew up in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, on the Monongahela River. He's, in a sense, a character like what we know of the Hillbilly Elegy character that J.D. Vance wrote about, from a part of America that just feels dispossessed. He goes home to McKeesport during the book, and he says around him, it looks like it's a nation that's been defeated in war. All the houses are boarded up. The people are gone. There's just nothing left. So he carries that anger that so many people from that part of the world, and let's be honest, Trump voters carry a sense of their world having been dispossessed. So that's part of who he is. In the CIA, he's asked to do something that he suspects is illegal, which is to penetrate a quote, journalistic organization in Europe run by an American. It's an organization that's very strange. It's got all sorts of new technology for not just creating fake news, but for creating fake events, from creating video and sound images of things that never really happened. He penetrates this, and then he's hung out to dry. That's the last thing I want to say about him, Diane. The book opens with him in court being convicted for having violated U.S. law in this operation. The CIA basically has let him take the fall in an operation. So he starts the book angry, not understanding why this was done to him, and determined to find out.
One of the elements of the book that so fascinated me was that it, part of it, takes place in Urbino, a part of Italy that you and I both know so well. We both received a glorious prize in Urbino. And I had never heard of Urbino until I was informed I was receiving the prize, and then traveled there to that glorious town. And you write about Urbino in this book.
When I received that wonderful award, I promised two of my Italian friends, who I'm sure you spent time with when you were there, that someday I would write about their beautiful city. Urbino is in the northeast of Italy, just back from the Adriatic coast. It's not well known. So it was fun setting the book there. I have an imaginary group of Italian computer wizards. And in truth, the Italians are at the absolute cutting edge of some of this cyber manipulation. People don't realize that, but the Russians are good. The Italians are really good. So it was fun to have a chance to revisit in my mind that beautiful place.
Michael Dunn is accused of and convicted for spying on or using American journalists. And I gather there's a specific prohibition in the CIA against doing that.
In the book, Diane, I quote from the language that's actually contained in the executive order that bounds the CIA, that all that language is precisely what exists in law. And the CIA is forbidden under this executive order from recruiting, manipulating, otherwise interfering with American journalists. So he is convicted of something that would be illegal if a CIA officer did it. Part of what I think is poignant about Dunn and about many real-life CIA officers is they get talked into doing things. They're told, well, technically that may be illegal, but you know it'll be okay. We have permission. We saw in the post 9/11 world where so many terrible things were done, CIA officers were told, this is okay, we've got legal permission. And then in many cases, they were just hung out to dry. They were left exposed. But I hope people will feel some sympathy for the foot soldiers who do what they think they're supposed to and then find themselves so vulnerable. That's not to excuse their actions, but you know, it's a sad fact that people don't always get the protections that they think they have.
There is an organization in the book called Fallen Empire, and that group engages in hacking and publishing. But should a group like that, which apparently is involving Americans, should it be protected under CIA guidelines?
So that's a fascinating question. Is Fallen Empire, which is a mischievous, politically anarchic and destructive group that's putting out false information, trying to sow discord, in the end also trying to help some pretty rotten people make money, should that get the protections of a journalistic organization? It's one of the questions that we confront when we think about WikiLeaks. Is WikiLeaks a news organization? Do we overlook their working with Russia to do things that affected our presidential election? How do we think about that? And that's one of the issues that's embedded in the book. I want people to think much harder about what journalism is, what real journalism is. I want people to think much harder about how we know what's true in this world. We are in a period where it's not just a question of fake news, but the ability to create fake events, events that appear to be real but never happened.
And these are what you call deep fakes. Explain deep fakes to us. I was fascinated to learn how these are done.
So deep fakes is the term that the industry has been using for several years, really, to describe a technique where you'll feed a lot of imagery into a neural network, into a very sophisticated computer system. And you'll feed these images in and you'll say, create Diane Rehm. And so they'll get every movement, facial gesture, you know, thousands of machine learning iterations for the computer. And then they'll run that neural network, that program, fake Diane Rehm, against another program, another neural network that has as its mission detect fake Diane Rehm. In other words, everything that's not quite right, every, you know, line, inflection that gives away the falsity of the image gets identified and then corrected. And you run these two networks against each other, and very quickly you have an incredibly powerful illusion. They're called generative adversarial networks, or GANs. Any of your listeners who really are into this stuff, I'm sure, are familiar with them. And these GANs are on the way to creating, you know, a David Ignatius, a Barack Obama, Diane Rehm, that can in the future be almost impossible to identify as a fake. Thank goodness DARPA, our research organization has a special unit called Media Forensics that's trying to work on how will we know that something is real? How are we going to verify that? But it's a very complicated problem.
And in the novel, can be used to create global economic chaos.
So let's say one of the examples in my book is creating information about a false oil spill with imagery that appears to show a massive leak, a market-moving danger that would transform the price of the oil company stock, the tanker stock, the regional economy. I have another example where false imagery is created to suggest that the CEO of a very powerful company traded on the stock market. You know, imagine a Berkshire Hathaway. You know, suppose we learned that Warren Buffett had some terrible medical issue. So in the book, somebody creates entirely believable evidence that this charismatic CEO has a fatal illness to crash the stock, to create arbitrage opportunities. So this is just coming at people, I think, faster than they realize. Very sophisticated hedge funds are already in the business of running machine learning data so that they can predict market movements. They see the future 10 seconds before it happens and are able to trade on it. So many scary things in the world. This is one that's worth thinking about. How do we know what's real? And it's going to be a business issue, a political issue, and for me, primarily a journalistic issue.
So to what extent do you think this may already be occurring now?
So I know examples in the financial world where people have very cleverly used technology. One of the examples in my book, every phone call that a CEO makes to financial analysts to forecast what his quarterly earnings are likely to be can be fed into a computer, and you can read in subtle changes in tone of the person's voice whether he's about to give good news or bad. You just run enough evidence and you really have this incredible predictive power. Predictive AI now is being used in very large systems to tell you when a pump is going to fail, when a valve is going to fail. They literally see the future. They see all the indices of what will happen, and then with high confidence they can predict when it will happen. They're seeing into the future. So you just think of the range of areas where these technologies make time elastic. We act on a future that we can predict with high degree of reliability. Our actions then condition everybody else around us. You know, as a novelist, it's really interesting to play with, but I have to say, this deserves a lot more study from people.
This is pretty scary stuff. If something goes up for a few seconds on video and then is taken down, somebody has seen it and somebody is prepared to act on it.
Yes, and here's another frightening thing. As people become more aware that this capability exists to create false imagery, it will be possible for people to claim that true images were in fact created. So imagine that at the time the Access Hollywood tape, which nearly sank Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign, imagine that people had been more aware of deepfake technology then. And Donald Trump had said, that never happened. That's manufactured. That sounds like my voice, but it isn't. You know, they created that in a lab. There would be a lot of people who would believe that this true evidence wasn't true. So one of the things that I hope people will think about as they read my book and think about these issues is, how can we have a system where we have greater confidence in the factual evidence that we need to make decisions? You know, at the Washington Post, we're putting a lot of time into our fact checker program. Glenn Kessler will give 4 Pinocchios if it's an obvious lie or a fake, but we need to do much more of that. I hope in the future that our big tech companies will flag things that they have reason to believe have been created. They shouldn't prevent you from looking at them. And we look at art forgeries all the time, but we want to know provenance. We'd like to know where this piece of art that we're looking at has been. We want to know some chain of reliability that makes us think this is real. It's not a forgery.
You know, I talked with John Lansing, the CEO of NPR, the other day, and asked why it takes so long to correct something that should be corrected right there in real time, so that there's not that gap between what you hear and or see and when a correction is made. And it's the same with the Washington Post. I mean, you do have somebody watching carefully, but it comes out perhaps a day later.
We need to be quicker, almost in real time. One thing I say, Diane, is that I think the truth in this age of manipulated information, the truth become more valuable now. You have millions, billions of dollars at risk. You need to know that the information you're trading on is accurate, and you'll pay a lot to have that confidence. I think, paradoxically, that may be one of the salvations for our news business, is people need to know the truth. And so trusted news organizations that people really do trust with their money, with their families' lives, I think it'll be a better time for us. Think of all of us coming out of the COVID-19 period. We know now how important our health and safety is. We know how much we need trusted sources of information, not to mention scientists who are working on it. So I think all these things, it's one of the positive sides of all this. Truth, expertise, real skill become more valuable now than they were.
More from David Ignatius when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Washington Post columnist David Ignatius. His new novel is titled The Paladin. David, how ready do you believe the U.S. is to combat these kinds of disinformation attempts in the 2020 election?
When you talk to the people in our intelligence agencies who are responsible for monitoring and combating this, they say that they think in the midterm elections in 2018, the U.S. had success in deterring the Russians, that the Russian behavior was less aggressive than it might have been. So, they express some confidence about that. I think the problem is that this issue of election security has somehow become partisan. You'd think if there was one thing we'd all agree on, it's that we want to have safe, secure elections. But there's been some Republican resistance to some proposals. And so, somehow as citizens, I think, we're going to have to be our own election police. I think that's, in the end, the answer to your question. Government agencies are trying to do things, but it's the vigilant citizen who makes an effort to make sure that what he or she sees is true, that your decisions aren't being shaped by some foreign government that's trying to manipulate you. It comes down to us. We have to take responsibility for this. I don't see any other way.
This week, the Senate held confirmation hearings to make John Ratcliffe the new director of national intelligence. Tell me about him and what your thinking is about that appointment.
John Ratcliffe is a former U.S. prosecutor, federal prosecutor. That's a positive. That's the kind of experience that you'd want for somebody overseeing intelligence. He's been a highly partisan figure as a member of Congress. supporting some of the more outlandish Trump administration proposals and some of their denials of Russian intervention in our politics. So there's been strong resistance to his appointment from Democrats. Senator Mark Warner, who's been a very responsible bipartisan member of this Senate Intelligence Committee, has said he thinks he's not suitable for this job. But a lot of the Republicans who were against him before seem to be softening, maybe because they see under current management of acting director Richard Grenell, the director of national intelligence, that's certainly not a desirable situation. We've had people getting fired, seeming politicization of our intelligence agencies. I think, Diane, our best hope here is going to be congressional oversight. The Congressional Intelligence Committees take their work really seriously. The Senate committees stayed pretty much bipartisan. And if Ratcliffe makes promises to that committee in the process of getting confirmed, I think the committee's going to be serious about making sure he lives up to them. This is the kind of thing where, you know, in a world where you can have pandemics that sweep from the value of good intelligence has never been more obvious than it is now. And the citizens' confidence that intelligence isn't being spun for political purposes, or isn't being ignored, as seems to have been the case. It seemed clear that our CIA and other intelligence agencies gave plenty of warning about the outbreak of COVID-19 in China. They kept messaging. There were some people on the NSC staff who understood entirely how serious this was in mid-January. There were meetings, briefings. The president just didn't want to, political reasons, he just didn't want to upset the country. He wanted to keep his economic recovery going. But boy, a situation where intelligence is suppressed about things like this, that's really dangerous.
And of course, the Trump administration at this point is putting forth the theory that the virus came from a lab in Wuhan. Does the intelligence back that up?
The intelligence, as I understand it, and I've spent some time reporting on this, is agnostic. The intelligence is clear that this was not a deliberately engineered man-made virus. That implication has been there in comments by President Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo, but the intelligence agencies are firm in saying that didn't happen. It is possible, however, that one of the laboratories or two big bio laboratories in Wuhan, where the virus started, it's possible that in scientific research in those laboratories where they were collecting lots of samples of bat coronaviruses of the sort that seemed to have begun this infection, it's possible that some of those very dangerous virus specimens leaked out. I mean, there are laboratory accidents all over the world. The Chinese lab safety record is not great. So I think our intelligence agencies say this happened as a result of an accident. It was either an accident in nature, it jumped from one species to another, but you can think of that as an accident, or it happened in an accident in a laboratory. And we don't know which. You shouldn't rule out one or the other. I think for sensible people, the right response to all this is to say China really has an obligation to all of us and to its own citizens to investigate this and find out what did happen. I mean, you know, their behavior has been pretty appalling, pretty typical of a police state, which is what China is. They try to suppress information. They try to prevent any real outside investigation when their own scientists began raising questions about a lab accident. That research was suppressed. I wrote about that 6 weeks ago. So the Chinese need to be transparent. The idea that this was a deliberate release by China, no evidence of that. But they do have a responsibility in helping all of us figure this out and prevent it from happening the next time.
And yet the back and forth between China and President Trump doesn't seem to augur well for that kind of mutual exchange and understanding.
You're quite right. It's been a poisonous exchange. It's been as nasty as any propaganda war I can remember from the Cold War days with the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The one thing that President Trump gets blasted for that I actually would see as a positive, a White House official once told me that you can sum up President Trump's China policy in one sentence: Xi Jinping is my friend. You know, I'm not against the idea of an American president having a relationship of trust and ability to talk with world leaders of every country. I think that's a good thing. And if Trump and Xi Jinping decided that they wanted to sponsor some sort of serious mutual investigation with peer-reviewed science, that would be a very positive thing. I think it would be good for China. I think they'd end up looking better. It certainly would be good for us. So it's not inconceivable that they could come to that kind of agreement, but in the current atmosphere where they're just slinging charges back and forth, it sure doesn't look very likely.
David, finally, with this pandemic sort of upending everything that's going on in our country and indeed around the world, do you see that the focus or the charge of the CIA is going to be changed or expanded in any way?
It's a great question. We see now that our national security is a more complicated matter than counting missiles or detecting other traditional threats. I think the CIA has been aware of that for a while. Their global monitoring of pandemic issues, for example, certainly since SARS has been serious. I think the issue is partly one of intelligence, but really more of politics. Our politicians have to understand that we live in an interdependent world, that what threatens our country can arrive from a distant place. We need to know about it. I think people will want to, have more secure national borders, that they'll want to feel that our country, whether it's America or Luxembourg, our country is safe and our citizens are protected. That's natural enough. So somehow a balance between this global interdependence that will make us safer and stronger national systems that protect the citizens of each individual country, I think that's where we're going to come out. A lot of that's policy. It's not the area that the CIA should be involved in. I just hope that our intelligence agencies avoid being politicized, because if they're politicized, if they become just targets for attack, as they have been in the last few years, young people are just not going to want to do that. They're going to say, why should I take a job where I'm just going to get pounded and my work is going to be mistrusted and devalued? And so I always, in my books, like to, say good things for the sort of men and women who are the foot soldiers in these agencies, because I think they're working pretty darn hard to make us safer.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about Dr. Bright, the physician who early on wanted to warn the American people about the coronavirus, and because he spoke out, was put into a totally different division and downgraded. What's your opinion of how that went down?
It's a shocking story. It's shocking in part because it reminds us of what happened in China to the courageous doctor in Wuhan, Dr. Li Wenjiang, who, when the outbreak began, noticed there was something new and dangerous that he saw and tried to report it, tried to ring alarm bells, contacted his colleagues, asked, are you seeing this? What can we do about it? And he was arrested. He ended up dying from COVID-19. He's now a martyr in China. Chinese people love him. They go to a website dedicated to him and just leave little prayers and poems. I don't know that Dr. Bright is a hero on that scale, but anytime I see somebody who's trying to alert citizens to danger and pays a price for it, I think that should be unacceptable. And people really, it's unacceptable because it's our safety. If the person who's trying to warn others of a danger to all of us pays a price for it, it just puts us at risk. And people should be furious about it. They just shouldn't allow it.
Is there anything else you want to say before we close?
So the only thing I want to say is what a pleasure it is to be talking with you. You and I go way back to the early days of the Diane Rehm Show. And I just am delighted to have a chance to talk with you. I feel like it wouldn't be a new book by me if I wasn't talking to Diane Rehm about it. So it's just great. And I'm just so glad you're continuing to do your podcast.
Thank you, David. That was David Ignatius. He's a columnist for The Washington Post, author of the new book, The Paladin. And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineer this week is Mike Kidd. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Stay safe. Stay well. I'm Diane Rehm.